And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Visit DirecTV.com. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Audible, presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Stuart Mandel, joined, as always, by Bruce Feldman. And Bruce, it's a new day for the Audible. I guess you could call this the Audible 3.0, as we officially join, the podcast officially joins the Athletics Podcast Network.
And this is how it benefits you, our loyal listener. We actually have halfway decent audio now, or even better than that. Tell me more, Stu. How did this happen?
Well, first of all, I just want to welcome a new member of the Audible team, John Hayes. He is our producer. He is the czar of all college football podcasts for The Athletic. And if you recognize his name, that's because he was Paul Feinbaum's producer for many years. John, what do you think is going to be more challenging, or what is more challenging, screening Feinbaum callers or teaching Bruce and I how to use podcast equipment?
Nothing gets worse, I promise you, than screening Feinbaum callers. 4 hours of phone calls with lines that just simply do not stop ringing. You guys are having issues there, as bad as those issues are. Screening Feinbaum callers is much worse, trust me.
Well, hey, if we are hurting for a guest 1 week, if we're trying to figure out how to fill content, maybe you can hook us up with Phyllis or I-Man or one of your other regulars, who I'm sure are still in your Rolodex.
Yeah, oh, don't worry. The first lady of Feinbaum, Phyllis from Olga, she's at the top of my contacts and favorites. She's the best. So anytime you want to have her on the show, let me know. I will say this, though, guys. We've had quite the launch, a number of podcasts hitting The Athletic over the last 3 weeks, but the network has felt a bit incomplete, and the reason why is because the Audible is not there yet, and finally it is. So it's a great day for The Athletic college football.
Hey, before we move on, Stu, I think we should point out there is an added bonus, right, if you are an Athletic subscriber?
Yes. So, first of all, this episode that we're doing here on September 9th should be the first one to pop up on your feed on the Athletic app. You can go to the podcast tab and press follow, and you will automatically know when a new episode pops in there. Now, you'll still be able to listen to this Monday episode, the full episode, wherever you have already gotten the Audible. But, Bruce, tell them the good news about more Audible.
Yes, so for our loyal subscribers to The Athletic, there will be a bonus edition of the Audible each week. And so it's just a little something more for the folks who have who've already joined and signed up and subscribed. And in a shameless shilling bit here, if you already do, great. And if you haven't yet, what are you waiting for? There's a lot more than just Stu and I, certainly. We have a ton of great content and a lot of great podcasts now. So if you haven't signed up, now's a great time to do it.
I can tell you this. The first thing I did Monday morning was listen to David Ubben and Joe Rexroad dissect the latest Tennessee debacle on the Vol for Life podcast. And there's a dozen more like that. And our friend Andy Staples has his own show that actually goes up late Saturday night, early Sunday morning, every week during the season. So no shortage of things for you guys to listen to. So this was a rare weekend where both Bruce and I were at games, and both proved to be pretty eventful.
All right, Stu. So I have to admit, I was a little jealous that you were going to be in Austin, Texas for the game, at least of the first month of the season, as I saw it, which was LSU with a revamped offense with Joe Brady coming in there against Texas. Sam Ellinger, great quarterback. You know, look, they took it to Georgia last year in the Sugar Bowl, the whole we're back. I think I am believing it. Tell me, you got firsthand. First of all, what was the atmosphere like? It sounded and seemed great from watching the game on TV. What was it like to actually be there?
Yeah, it was a big time atmosphere, and of course, that meant for a lot of people bringing up just how much better it's gotten there. Now, it didn't occur to me until I got there that, because I've been through Austin several times over the last few years in the spring for off-season visits, but I was like, when was the last time I was here for a game? And I thought about it, and I thought about it, and I thought about it. I think it might have been as far back as the Colt McCoy, Texas, Ohio State, I think it was 1-2 or 2-3 game way back, like 2006.
That's like 12 years ago.
Now, what part of the reason is, well, there's two reasons, right? One, Texas got to be pretty mediocre and stayed that way for most of this decade. But even when they still had it going, what would be the biggest game every year? Oklahoma. So I went to several of those in Dallas, and I certainly remember seeing Texas on the road. But a Texas home game, it had been a long time. And it's just a much different atmosphere there. I give a lot of credit to Chris Del Conte, the athletic director who came over from TCU, who's done a lot of things to help with that. But, you know, at the end of the day, it was about the fact that it was two top 10 teams that don't usually get to play each other. Game day being there for the first time in a decade. So the atmosphere was great. So were the Torchy's Tacos the night before the game, by the way. Shout out, Crossroads Taco. Best taco you could possibly have. But, you know, the obvious winner of the weekend, or the breakout star of the weekend, was Joe Burrow, who had a decent first season for LSU last year, but I don't know that the average college football fan came away thinking, you know, this guy is a star. And then, of course, you more than anybody has been talking up Joe Brady and all the changes to the offense this offseason, and we got to see that play out. I mean,
so are you a believer in Joe Brady now?
Yes, of course. And, you know, I give Ed Orgeron a lot of credit. He acknowledged this in the postgame that, you know, he said, this is the vision I had for this offense when I took over, which would have been in 2017. But there were a couple miscues to get where they are now. First, it was Matt Canada. That didn't work out. Goes back to Steve Ensminger. Last year, they did do some different things, but not that different. And then this is an entirely different offense. But, you know, you can talk about scheme all you want. You got to have the quarterback. And I think what really stands out is LSU's got one heck of a group of receivers right now. And that game was the first time in school history that they had three 100-yard receivers. The play of the game, obviously, the third and 17. No running up the middle and eat some clock and punt it. They go for it. And I was on the LSU sideline at that point, and it looked like Burrow was going to get creamed at one point. But no, he stood up, stood tall, moved in the pocket, and delivers a dart to Justin Jefferson. Not Jordan Jefferson, his older brother. Justin Jefferson, who breaks it for the 61-yard touchdown. So obviously big performance for LSU. It's not like Sam Ellinger didn't do anything himself. I mean, they could not, LSU, by Orgeron's own admission, could not stop Texas in the second half. They scored on every possession. But, you know, the hard thing about that is LSU also had pretty much its entire, you name the key defender, they either cramped up or left with an ankle sprain or whatnot during the second half. So it's hard to say, like, well, should we be worried about LSU's defense? They gave up all these yards to Texas. Or was that kind of one of these products of 102 degree weather? Guys just, I mean, they were gassed. They, you know, they flat out couldn't stop them in the second half.
Well, a couple of things just from watching the game and talking to some of the folks on the LSU staff since the game. So I agree with you. I think the most underrated aspect of what emerged Saturday night is that receiving core is big, big time. You know, it's going to get overshadowed by the guys at Alabama. At least it will, unless they can prove, you know, they can prove that they can overtake the Tide in, you know, in a month and a half or 2 months when they play. But they, Justin Jefferson is an interesting kid. I mean, he was the last recruit that Orgeron signed. He was the lowest rated kid in the class, and you watch him, and he's been the best receiver they've had really since he's got there. And just a really good route runner and a really competitive, tough kid. And he's a go-to guy. And the other two guys, Ja'Marr Chase, when I was down there in the spring for a week, Ja'Marr Chase was creating a lot of buzz. They couldn't cover him. He's physical. He's tough. And Terrace Marshall, who was actually the highest rated receiver recruit of all of them, he was injured his senior year. I took him a little while to get back from it. He's 100% now. I think he's a legit big play guy. So you put those three guys together with Burrow, who plays with a ton of confidence and he's accurate and he's a better athlete than I think a lot of people realize. I mean, they're really dangerous. And what, you know, what you see with this group, I think, is it is really aggressive. And that comes from Brady, the pass game coordinator, what he brought in from the Saints, and also some of the stuff he got from being under Joe Moorhead at Penn State. And this is what Ogeron talked about for a long time. I mean, I remember him telling me about Joe Brady long before he ever had an opening about what he thought of this guy. And so, and look, if you haven't read the Athletic story on Joe Brady from about 2 months ago, I would encourage you to do it, just because he kind of outlines where he came from and how he got up on his radar. Now, the other part of this, which I think, you know, you hit on, is this: in the second half, LSU's defense really had no answers, and it felt a lot like the Texas A&M LSU overtime game last year was just back and forth. The only difference was LSU had an advantage because they were benefited by a drop ball by Keontae Ingram in the red zone at the goal line, and then they had a great goal line stand, you know, a couple minutes later, so Texas got no points out of it. I think if you're an LSU fan, I think your biggest takeaway, you can be excited about the offense, but you can think, wow, we won against a top 10 team on the road with Grant Delpit playing a really bad game, who's arguably the best defensive player in the country, and with Christian Fulton, one of the best cornerbacks in the country, playing a really bad game. I mean, if those guys, and if and when those guys get it cranked up, I mean, the defense will be markedly better. We saw the one guy on defense who really did shine in there was Derek Stingley, the true freshman cornerback who they've been raving about since he got there. I mean, he played really well. The defensive line did not get great pass rush. I mean, when Aranda did a few things that to scheme up some stuff, they got pressure on Sam Ellinger, but it was not a great night from that defense. But I think there's enough playmakers there who will come into form better, but not a great night for Grant Delpit and Fulton. On the other side,
can I just say something real quick there?
Yes.
You know, Fulton did get hurt late in the first half and left. I mean, it wasn't even late in the first half. At some point in the first half, he got hurt. He left for a little bit. He came back, and I don't think he was the same after that. Delpit, though, that, you know, that was puzzling because he is supposed to be one of, if not the best, defensive players in the country.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. I thought about this a little bit. Is Sam Ellinger's comments about Texas being back, I actually think, and it's maybe hypocritical to say this one, I won't let anybody say it on the Miami part of it, but I actually do think Texas is back. I watched them. This was the best offensive line that Texas, this is the best Texas has looked on the offensive line in about a dozen years. And I think even without Colin Johnson having a big game, we saw Devin Duvernay really step up. I don't know, you know, Keontae Ingram wasn't able to do much, but I thought the offensive line against a good, not a great LSU defensive line, really was impressive. And I think I'm going to give them a little bit of a pass on the secondary because they're so young. And I think this is such a big time group of receivers and a really good scheme right now that I think was just kind of rolling. I feel like this Texas team, like, I'm not backing off that they're going to win the Big 12 and go to the playoff after what I saw on Saturday night. Are you with me?
Wait. Playoff. So you think they're running the table from here, basically?
I think so, yeah.
That's a bold, bold prediction. I admire it. I'm sticking with Oklahoma. But nothing about the game soured me on Texas in any way. I was, you know, we can talk more about the Clemson A&M game in a minute, but, you know, that's one where made you temper expectations a little bit for the Aggies, whereas, you know, Texas is where I thought they would be, maybe even a little bit ahead. I think the only area where, well, two. So, you know, running back right now, Keontae Ingram's all they've got. Jordan Whittington and two other guys are out. And Ingram has the makings of a really good back. I don't think he's quite there yet.
Rashad Johnson ran the ball hard.
He did. And then, I mean, believe me, for a guy who is a true freshman who was practicing quarterback for most of up until about a couple weeks ago, you know, he knows what he's doing.
What was crazy no, I think was, where the... I Kirk Herbstreit made this point, and it kind of sunk in. I was like, heard it, and then I kind of thought about it for a little bit. He was like, he hadn't played running back since he was in the fifth grade till about 2 weeks ago. And then he's going up on a Saturday night in a huge stadium, you know, a huge stage against LSU. And I thought, I was like, man, this kid runs hard. I thought he was very impressive what he did.
You know, Ingram, the thing is, what a different game that might have been. Texas twice got inside the 5-yard line, fourth and goal, in the first half and came up empty. And one of them was when Ingram dropped a wide open touchdown. So, no, what I was going to say is, I think the only area where they're not quite, you know, the difference between where, with a, you know, if you look at Texas's roster versus Alabama, Clemson, Georgia, you know, the what we consider the elite right now is defensive line. Malcolm Roach is a veteran. He's really good. The other guys are either not quite there or, you know, the better talent is maybe not even ready to be out there just yet. And so that, you know, that's a reason why Todd Orlando has to kind of blitz relentlessly. And it worked at first, but once Burrow figured out what was going on, he kind of, that allowed him to have time to, you know, find holes in that secondary. I don't think Texas is secondary. You know, you mentioned they're young. They are. I don't think they were necessarily bad, and that's the reason Burrow threw for all those yards. He just was firing it into the perfect spot over and over and over again. So, now, like you said, if LSU's defense, if that was an indication of LSU's defense, then they're going to have trouble against Alabama. They're going to have trouble against A&M at the end of the year. So they need to get that in gear. But I guess I'm just not that worried about it because I know who some of those players are.
Yeah, and they're young. They're really young in the secondary. And I do think those freshman cornerbacks, they're true freshmen, will be pushing for more playing time. And I think you'll see probably a little more. The one area I don't think they're going to get that much better on is the D-line. Their D-line has good personnel. It's not great personnel. And that's the area where I think that they can be good enough, I think, to get to the playoff. And we'll see. I mean, the way the offense is playing, who knows how, you know, if they can be a national title caliber team. Because I think this offense is way different than anything people have seen about LSU in a long time. It's just, that's the one area where I'm like, okay, they got to get better, and they got to find better, you know, ways to pressure the quarterback, and we'll see if they can get that done.
Well, if they can't, they're not going to beat Alabama for the umpteenth year in a row.
You know what I think is different, probably, Stu, just on the Alabama piece, and this is something I think we talked about in our text exchange. This might be the first time, because of that offense, where I think they can call a game and play it a little more aggressively because, whoa, now all of a sudden Brent Venables is super aggressive, and that includes when he plays against Alabama. And it's because he knows I don't have to win a game 13-10 or 10-7. We can be really, really aggressive with what we do and take some gambles because I know our offense can put up 28, 35, 42 points. I think as we start seeing more of this Joe Burrow, Joe Brady kind of dynamic going, I think that'll help Dave Aranda and that defense be a more aggressive when they get in that game. I'm not saying they're going to win in Tuscaloosa, but I think that's the biggest difference is it'll help the defense because you won't have to feel like we can't afford to give up a touchdown, and as soon as that happens, all of a sudden we wilt.
What I was going to say is, and a lot of people listening right now are going to cringe, they might not need to beat Alabama to make the playoff because I'm starting to see where the two SEC team scenario this year could be even more realistic than we would have thought because of this. LSU just beat a top 10 team in non-conference. Let's say Texas stays a top 10 team. That's a pretty big victory to have in your pocket if you're an 11-1 team that didn't win the SEC. Georgia plays Notre Dame in a couple weeks. I don't know how Notre Dame's going to finish, but they're going to be a top 10 team going into that game. So if Georgia is that team that doesn't, you know, loses in the SEC title game, isn't the SEC champion, but only has one loss, and a win against Notre Dame out of conference, they have a really good case to be in the playoff. And Alabama, as we know, is playing nobody in the out of conference, but they're Alabama, and they'll always get in if they have one loss. So gear up for that to be a contentious point of conversation once they start doing those.
So Stu, what you're saying is if you're an LSU fan, you should be rooting for Notre Dame in a couple weeks.
Wait, how does that impact them?
Well, that would impact them because if LSU is 11-1 and then Georgia goes to the SEC title game to play Alabama at 11-1 and then they lose, then they're a two-loss Georgia team that they're out, then they're not going to be the second team to go.
Good point, Bruce. You're right. All right, start plotting for that now. I don't think Notre Dame's going to beat Georgia, just being realistic on the road in Athens. As you know, I picked Georgia to win the national title, so we'll revisit that when we get there. Okay, I did not, you know, you were excited to go to the Colorado-Nebraska game, but I can't imagine you thought you were going to see anything like what you did.
No, let's start with the atmosphere here, because you want to talk about what your situation. I had not been in Boulder, Colorado since Chris Brown ran all over Nebraska Thanksgiving weekend like 18 years ago. So I think it's pre-Klatt days even. That's how long ago.
That was so long ago that the coaches in that game were Frank Solich for Nebraska and my man Gary Barnett for Colorado.
Yes, long, long time ago. So, you know, it's a gorgeous place, gorgeous venue. Everything is great about it. Talking to Nebraska folks, because there was a lot of red in town, and this is a rivalry that's way more cranked up than I think a lot of people not connected with these two fan bases would realize. Nebraska people I talked to were like, yeah, don't be surprised if it's going to be like 70-30, maybe even 60-40, that there would be that many Nebraska fans in the building. Well, come kickoff, it was actually like 70-30 the other way. There was like 70% Nebraska fans in there. And Nebraska looked very good. They were aggressive. Adrian Martinez starts out 9-for-9, jump out to a 17-0 lead, and they had it for a big chunk of the second half. And then there were a couple of big coverage busts for Nebraska. It looked like Nebraska started to run out of gas a little bit. And I think some of what seeped in was they have really struggled, especially in the last year, in close games under Scott Frost. Hadn't won a road game. I think the number was 1-5 in games decided by 5 points. And you saw more momentum. And I think the area where Colorado is very good, like a lot of other teams in the country, we talked about LSU, we talked about Alabama, they have really, really good receivers. It's not just LaVisca. He's phenomenal. But KD Nixon is maybe the most dynamic guy in the Pac-12. And Tony Brown's a really good receiver. So they have weapons for Steven Montez, and he got hot, and Nebraska looked like they ran out of gas. And it turned out to be a crazy finish that went into overtime. And before the game, one of the things our crew does, and I assume a lot of other crews do this, is you check with the head coach or check with the special teams coordinator and say, where are you comfortable with your kicker from what yard line? And I don't know, 15 minutes before kickoff, Scott Frost told me, because they were going with the punter, because of an injury, the punter had to be the place kicker. And he said, probably if we can get the ball to the 25. Well, there was a sack on Adrian Martinez, and it was a long kick, and the kicker missed it, and the crowd went wild, and we had a field storming. And it was a pretty awesome scene to be in the middle of. And I have a big tip of the hat to Mel Tucker, who was it was awesome to be next to him and you know, through this and seeing how it was his first win at Folsom Field as the Buffs head coach. And I think I told you this offline, Stu, yesterday. I talked to him coming out on the field right before the third quarter, and they're, like I said, down 17-0, did nothing on offense, and he outlined in a very poised, cool way, like about 5 things that needed to happen for them to come back and win, why he was confident those things would happen. And everything he said, everything came true. And he was very poised and measured throughout. And it was probably one of the better halftime interviews I've ever had with a coach, especially a coach who's losing and down in a big hole. And look, the CU team under Mike McIntyre also rallied from 2 touchdowns down against Nebraska the previous year. So I think those players had that in their minds already. But, you know, a pretty amazing scene to be in the middle of. And if you're a Nebraska fan, boy, that was a tough ride back to Nebraska, knowing, man, we feel like we're better. We keep hearing we're better, and we're still losing these games. And I think it's the only saving grace, I think, for them is that this was a non-conference game and they can still go win the Big Ten West. But right now, boy, that was a tough one to swallow.
Yeah, the Nebraska thing, the Scott Frost thing, is a little puzzling because he, and maybe he doesn't help himself with how honest he is or confident, but you know, he did not shy away this offseason, this preseason, from saying, oh yeah, we're a lot better. We're a lot better. You know, we're better at every position, was one of his quotes. And then they come out and they don't look that great against South Alabama, and they blow this game against Colorado, which I think has got to be doubly heartbreaking because it is still a rival. I mean, Mel Tucker, I talked to him on Sunday, said he kept referencing December 5th. That was the day he was hired. He says, there's not a day that's gone by since December 5th that somebody hasn't mentioned the Nebraska game to me. Now, maybe it's bigger for Colorado than it is for Nebraska, but the fact that there were 30,000 Nebraska fans there tells me that's not the case. So Adrian Martinez was really frustrated after the game, had some kind of uncharacteristic comments, and that's where I'm a little concerned. I feel like the hype train got a little out of control there. You know, when a guy starts as a true freshman and has success, kind of the sky's the limit kind of feeling goes out there, and he's starting to be mentioned as a Heisman candidate. He's on magazine covers. Two games into the season, we're not seeing that yet from him.
I think he's still a young quarterback, and we're seeing a lot of the pieces around him are still young. By the way, on the rivalry, Mel Tucker had an interesting little anecdote. He said, I'm out in California in the off season, and I'm meeting with some boosters, and I just happened to pull out a pack of Big Red gum. And one of the boosters like kind of knocked it out of his hand. And Mel goes, I was like, what was I thinking? And I was like, really that bad? And he was like, yeah, that's the deal, man. So
pretty nasty for teams that aren't in the same conference, don't play that often anymore. Hey, real quick. So you were part of I'm in the press box at Texas watching it on Fox Sports app, and I didn't have the sound of your interview, but I saw you. I mean, it was, so now I went through that once. I mean, I've only done those post-game interviews twice on TV on the same day in 2014 for FS1, and one of them was a field storming at Baylor. It looked pretty frantic. I know, like, in that moment, you're entirely focused on, I've got to get the interview. But they were, based on what camera angle they were showing it from, I could tell that your field camera guy didn't make it. You know, how did you make that interview even happen?
Yeah, so one of the things we talked about before the game, because we kind of knew if they win, they're going to storm the field, was just get the interview and don't necessarily worry if our camera guy is there for that. Normally, when there's not a field storm, you got to wait for your shot. In this case, it was like, okay, they may be documenting it in a different way. And so I just made sure I was able to get to Mel pretty quick, and he came, you know, he kind of found me, and we got lined up. The only downside was I felt like it went really well. And then as I got into the truck and talked to our producer, Bo, I think he was the one who told me, I was like, yeah, your mic was cutting out a little bit. And I think that's the thing that's kind of hard to predict is when you're in the middle of chaos and there's all these people, how well the technology might hold up. And then when I watched it back, it was probably a little better than I thought it was going to be, but it was definitely just chaos. And it's like, you can kind of prepare your mind for chaos, but just those things are just going to happen. So it's very cool moment to be in the middle of. One thing about getting back to Nebraska quick, Scott Frost, I think, had told us in our meeting on Friday night, they have to play smarter. That was kind of the difference in those close games. And they did not play smart at all, especially in the second half or in overtime. And that came back to bite them. And until they can do that, they definitely have a lot more talent. I do think they're a lot better than they were last year. But if they're not a lot smarter, never mind the Big Ten West, they're going to only be like a six win team if they don't play smarter against, you know, still a pretty competitive conference. And I think that's the challenge for them, is to learn from this and see if they can grow up a lot faster.
Back to the podcast in a second, but first, a word about FanDuel. Fantasy football season is here, and this season there are more ways to win than ever because FanDuel has more ways to win cash prizes, once-in-a-lifetime experiences during every single game, every single week. If you've never played FanDuel Fantasy Football before, great. New users get $20 inside credit if they deposit $20. Daily fantasy is great because you don't get stuck in a lineup you'll regret. You pick a new team every week. Injuries, busts, don't end your season, and there's a chance to win millions of dollars. So sign up for FanDuel now. Get $20 in bonus. Just make your first deposit of $20 to get started, and you'll get an extra $5 in site credit every week for 4 weeks. Go to FanDuel.com/DFS Fantasy. Daily Fantasy Sports Fantasy. DFS Fantasy. Or download the FanDuel app. That's FanDuel.com/DFS Fantasy. All right, so earlier in the podcast, I gave you some props for your Joe Brady coverage coming to fruition. Now I'm going to give you a little bit of flack for two prophecies that aren't looking so hot right now. For one, you probably the front of the bandwagon of Josh Gattis and what he was going to do for the Michigan offense, best offensive line in the country, one of the best, or maybe one of. I watched the entirety, basically, of the Michigan-Army game. And this wasn't like the Oklahoma one last year where Oklahoma's defense was so bad they just couldn't get Army off the field. Because in that situation, you know, when Oklahoma did get the ball, which wasn't very often, Kyler Murray just marched them right down the field. The reason this game went to overtime is that Michigan's offense could not handle Army's defense. The pressure, Shea Patterson had a couple fumbles, pretty much all game. The Army defensive front won that battle. And obviously, if you're a Michigan fan right now, you're concerned. The other one I was going to ask you about, when is your Chip Kelly UCLA Bruins going to have this big magical breakthrough that we've been waiting for?
The first one, I would say, look, I'm not going to turn around and go, okay, this is going to be a disaster. Neither of these things are going to come true. I'm not saying that. I think both will happen. I'm pretty confident that at some point UCLA will get it going and they will run it down people's throats in ways that they won't be able to handle the counter punches. Because I just think eventually this stuff is going to click and that it will work. Because he's too
I'm not
smart.
Saying that's
he's too smart of a coach, and his track record shows. Like this is I use this example a lot, even though the systems are very different. There were people after the first 2 years thinking, all right, the air raid's all over the place. Mike Leach, you know, people have figured it out. Well, you know what? They didn't really figure it out. Now, granted, Mike Leach is more similar now at Washington State that compared to what he was at Texas Tech, whereas Chip Kelly and what they're doing is quite different than what he was running years ago. But I just think it comes back to the coach and the belief in what they're doing, not necessarily how they do it. And so that's why I'm not, like, it's going to happen. It's certainly taken longer than I thought. Like, I didn't think they would lose this game to San Diego State. And their offense has been a dud so far. We have them this week against Oklahoma. I mean, if they make this
game. Have your filler material ready.
Yeah. If they make this game competitive into the second half, I think that's a moral victory for them at this point. Right now, they are looking at a 0-4 start, which is feels a lot like last year.
So look, you're there in LA. You are definitely more plugged in there than I am or anybody is really. But man, you are really out there on an island right now. I think everybody else is looking at it and going, not that the game has passed them by necessarily, but that Andy Staples had a great column on our site Monday morning about this, that you know, the stuff he was doing a decade ago that was so innovative, everybody's doing now.
But the stuff he's doing now is not the stuff that he was doing.
But that's the question. The stuff he's doing now is the stuff that he brought with him from the NFL.
It's not,
there's
though.
A question of,
that's
is
the
that
thing.
Too...
But it's not the stuff he brought with him from the NFL. Like, I think this stuff is very different, and I think it will start to click. Now, look, they're not very good on the offensive line at this point, and I think that's made it challenging. Certainly not having Josh Kelly the week one didn't help, and then he wasn't great in week two. But I do think it's going to start to click. It's just, you know, to me, again, I go back to having a good feel for what you guys have. I mean, this is still a very, very young team. It's probably the youngest team in college football at this point, if you look at all the freshmen and sophomores. I thought they would still be better at this point, but it'll happen. I mean, the one I don't have quite as good a read on, and I'm not saying, like, you know, I bet my house that UCLA in 2020 would be a 9-win team, but I do think they will get there eventually. Michigan, I thought they would have been better last week. I don't know exactly where the disconnect is. I mean, certainly I did see the beginning of the game where, you know, Patterson's turnovers, it just felt like, I don't know, you know, there are some similarities to LSU and Michigan. Certainly both new, and Joe Brady's not the offensive coordinator, he's the pass game coordinator, whereas Josh Gattis, this is his show. But they're both guys who learned a lot under Joe Moorhead. I think the biggest difference between the two, because both teams have really, you know, big time receiver groups, I think the biggest difference is I have a lot more confidence in Joe Burrow as a trigger man than I do in Shea Patterson. And I think that's one of the, I'm not saying this is all a Shea Patterson issue, but I think that's where the struggle is coming from, as much as the growing pains are. And if he can play cleaner, I think the offensive line will get better as the year goes on. I'm not giving up on my pick of Michigan winning the Big Ten this year.
Man, I admire your conviction in your opinions. I mean, this is the definition of belief without evidence.
I thought you were gonna say it's the definition of insanity.
Maybe. I mean,
time will tell.
But I was saying that when Michigan got, you know, was started the season in the top 10. You know, I think you're right about Patterson. I think that through no fault of his own, the expectations for him have been higher than should be, because he was a big time recruit. He played as a freshman at Ole Miss, and, you know, there was just so much publicity surrounding the circumstances of his transfer. So then he gets there and they got on a roll last year, and suddenly it becomes that he's the savior. Well, I think his ceiling is not as high as people thought. There is obviously some feeling amongst the fan base that they should be switching to McCaffrey, who has played a little bit, but clearly Patterson's still the guy. And I just also think there's a little bit of, you know, you talked about the receivers. You know, they're good, but those LSU receivers I saw on Saturday night are more talented. I wonder if this just kind of blanket assumption that Michigan's got all this talent on offense is not necessarily there. I'm not saying they're bad by any means. They've got some players, but I don't think, you know, the receivers that are lining up, heck, the receivers are lining up for Ohio State even. You know, they may be not quite as finished of products. Some of them are very young, but I just don't think that the Michigan group is on that level. So it doesn't really matter what scheme you're going to run if you don't have the players to do it. So I'm sure they'll play better than they did Saturday. That was one of those everything that could go wrong did go wrong circumstances, but I don't know. I think people may need to temper expectations a little bit, though you certainly are not.
I think when you say that, I think everybody has tempered expectations. I feel like I'm the only one who hasn't at this point on Michigan. Is that what you're saying?
They are still in the top 10. You know, it would be weird to drop a team really far for a game they actually won, but, you know, right now they're still considered a top 10 team. Whereas if I'm, you know, looking at the Big Ten landscape right now, you know, Ohio State's still, you know, they've done nothing to think that they can't be a Big Ten title contender and a playoff contender. And the one that I think has been a pleasant surprise, and admittedly against two nobodies, is Wisconsin, who had such a disappointing season last year, but has opened this season on fire, has shut out both of their first two opponents, and plays Michigan in 2 weeks. So that could become a pretty intriguing matchup.
Yeah, I'm with you. We'll find out a lot about both teams week four. And that one, I'm not sold on Wisconsin at this point. And like you said, they haven't played nobodies, but they've done about everything you could ask them to do at this point. So,
I mean, USF shouldn't be a nobody.
USF is really, you know, let's talk about this for really 2 seconds. USF has really gone into a tailspin right
eight
now.
Losses in a
oh
row.
Oh, God.
Now, Quentin Flowers was clearly the guy there and the main reason behind the, you know, they had two great seasons in a row there, the Willie Taggart's last year and Charlie Strong's first year. But Blake Barnett got them off to a 7-0 start last year, and they haven't won a game since. He got benched this past week. It feels a little bit, starting to feel a little bit like Charlie Strong's Texas tenure, where he's just kind of struggling for answers on the offensive side of the ball. Here's a segue. Guess here's a team in your backyard that is no longer struggling for offensive answers.
Okay, this is where I was hoping you were going to go. So
yeah.
How much hype should we be have right now for a guy who started one game and it was on really late at night and he looked fantastic? And there are people going, oh, this is Sam Darnold all over again. It was a quarterback who did not come in with a ton of recruiting hype and kind of snuck in the back door a little bit and then all of a sudden got people really excited. And a lot of people in LA think that Sam Darnold saved Clay Helton's job. Is Keaton Slovis going to do the same thing?
First of all, you said very late at night. The Cal-Washington game hadn't even kicked off. We hadn't made it past the first 5 minutes of the first quarter when that game ended. How could there not be hype? That was as flawless a debut, first start, as you could ask for against a Stanford team that is, you know, I mean, maybe they exposed some flaws in their defense in that game, but it's not, you know, it's not USF. It's Stanford. He looked fantastic. You know, I think the fact that he wasn't a heralded recruit doesn't really matter. Clearly, since the minute he got there, they've been talking him up. Graham Harrell's been talking him up. I mean, I would ask you, even if JT Daniels didn't get hurt, is it possible that this switch was going to happen at some point? Because it seems like, I mean, JT Daniels started a whole season as a true freshman last year, and he never played the way this guy did the other night.
No. Now, look, in fairness to those guys, USC also has a really good group of receivers, and I think we saw them show up time and again. But this kid's really, really accurate, and there's something about him that's kind of unassuming. I actually met him a year ago before one of the USC games. And when I met him, usually on a kid who's committed, especially out here, there's enough buzz around him where you kind of know a decent amount about him. I actually thought he was a 2020 recruit, which would have meant he'd still be in high school. And if you looked at him physically, I would have guessed he was 6'2", 180 pounds back then. I mean, he just didn't look like the guy where you'd say, okay, this looks like a guy who's ready to jump into college next year and be the starter. This will be mentioned 1,000 times between now and probably next Saturday. He's the Kurt Warner protege from Arizona and had a lot of intricate stuff thrown at him and handled it all really well. I think the thing that I was very impressed with was just ball placement. Everything was so accurate and so on point. So let's see. They got they have BYU, and we'll get to BYU in a second because they had an interesting game last week. But they have BYU, and then on Friday night, our crew has what now looks like must-see TV. Utah is coming in there. Utah might be in the top 10. USC might be in the top 20. How good can USC be this year? And you had what did you give them? You and Andy both. I was 8-4. I think you and Andy were like 6-6 on USC. Your predictions?
No, I think I was either 8-4 or 7-5.
You were 7-5.
I mean, this, you know, the overwhelming storyline with USC has been Clay Helton's job, and I feel like this development is the best thing that could have possibly happened for him, because now everybody's focused on Keaton Slovis. And
so what do you think they're going to do now?
Lose one of these next two games, everybody will still be frustrated. But
put
people feel like, okay, here's a reason for hope.
Put your chips on the table. Give me a prediction now. You get a chance to revisit your 7-5. Are you staying with 7-5? The schedule's still tough, although Washington just lost to Cal, and they don't look as daunting. So what are you looking at now?
Well, I got to pull up their schedule. It is. I mean, it's all about these first six games. You knew that there was a possibility they would lose two or more of these first two games. Now let's reassess, right? They got through Stanford. I think they'll be BYU, who I don't think is very good, but right, did manage to win in an SEC stadium. And then I think, you know, the season will be decided basically of that three-game stretch, Utah, at Washington, at Notre Dame. I think the team could go. I think the Bruins,
Through that stretch, gets very interesting then.
They'll be in pretty good shape. I think that my revised prediction for USC would be
10-2.
9-3.
Okay. 9-3.
Okay, you're going 10-2, I'm going 9-3.
9-3.
Would either of those scenarios save Clay Helton, given that, you know, he could be not only, you know, have a better record than people expect, but like, hey, what is Keaton Slovis going to do as a sophomore?
I don't think 9-3 will be good enough.
Yeah.
I just think that there's going to be enough USC power brokers who are going to go, we weren't sure about Clay Helton before. Year four, they're 9-3. I get it that we have a really good young quarterback, maybe a great young quarterback. But recruiting with all this uncertainty has really tailed off. They are missing on a lot of kids who they would normally be USC kids. I just think it's really, really hard unless you can get a resounding yes, and that's a playoff spot, to sell to people that this is going to be our guy for the next 5 years, not we're going to be touch and go every year.
We joked about this during the brief time it was Cliff Kingsbury as the OC, but I really do think that if you got to the end of the season and they weren't good enough to justify keeping Clay Helton, but they're still, you know, so good on offense and the quarterback looks great, that they could say the new head coach of the USC Trojans is Graham Harrell.
You think they should do that?
No, I'm not saying they should do that. It's only been one big game. But if you feel like, well, the offense is actually doing its part and it's been a big improvement, and you know, we want to keep the quarterback coach relationship going, it would be very unusual. Usually if head coach gets fired, so does everybody below him, although I guess Ogeron would be the perfect example of the opposite of that. So
I think what's different there is
we shall see.
If you're doing that, I think you should keep Clay Helton on, because to me, and I like Graham, I think he's really smart, but the idea that I don't think Graham is that much like Lincoln Riley in personality. And you have guys who are at similar stages, although Lincoln Riley, I think, had more experience in these settings than Graham would have. But I think if you tell me, you know what, and I wouldn't say this should be like head coach in waiting, but if Clay Helton can manage some of the administrative things, and like he's doing right now, at least letting Graham Harrell run the offense, then I think that that's a more of a selling point. But if I'm USC, and let's say it goes and they go 10-2, they don't go to the playoff, but they go 10-2, and you want to keep Clay Helton, you want to keep everything, they have to find a way to make it seem like we're not looking back. He could go 7-5 next year in 2020, and he's still going to be the head coach, because all this uncertainty, they can't just live in this world that way for much longer.
No. Well, like I said before the season, every week's going to be a soap opera with USC this season. I guess the second episode was particularly exciting. We'll see where it goes from there. You mentioned Washington losing. So I did stay up till 3:30 a.m. Central. I guess it wasn't as bad as being on the East Coast to catch the end of – it was actually a pretty exciting ending of Washington-Cal. Cal wins on a late field goal. It was actually kind of fun having – been at Cal a couple times in the spring and doing their state of the program, seeing some of the guys that were talked about in the spring, you know, stepping up and emerging. They have a couple really good running backs now in Chris Brown and Marcel Dancy.
This is the second Chris Brown reference in this podcast.
I know it is. It's being hard to keep. He's Chris Brown Jr. Maybe that'll help keep track of it. But in terms of Washington, their offense wasn't great. The last
tell me what you thought of Jacob Eason in that one. This is a good, by the way, this is a good secondary. This is a terrific secondary and a really good defense.
It is. Your guy, I worried because your guy Ashton Davis went down at one point, but it didn't look too serious. He struggled. I mean, there's no other way to put it. He looked very ordinary. I think that there's a lot riding on him, that he would be the big upgrade from Jake Browning, and obviously that didn't look that way the other night, but like you said, against a very good, not just a very good secondary, a very good defense. Evan Weaver had like
18 tackles.
Yeah, and they said at some point that that was some absurd streak he now has of 10 tackles, having at least 10 tackles in a game. I think that's he's an All-America candidate who nobody outside of Berkeley knows much about. Anyway, yeah, I'm wondering what answers Coach Pete might have for his offense. They're definitely facing some questions after the way that went the other night. I think if you're an Oregon fan, you would have to have been pleased to see that. Washington State fan, maybe there's a window of opportunity there that you didn't necessarily see coming before the season.
Stu, we mentioned BYU a little bit earlier. BYU had a surprising upset win, come from behind in Knoxville. Tennessee is so much worse than I thought they were. They're looking at like a 1-6 start right now. And we talked earlier, to me, the difference between why there should be panic if you're a Tennessee fan than compare if you some of the earlier ones is because Jeremy Pruitt's never done it as a head coach. Where do you think this is going to go? I mean, there's Tennessee fans who are thinking, oh man, Phil Fulmer may end up taking this over and firing him and then becoming the head coach himself.
I keep both of the last 2 weeks, I've half thought I'd wake up Sunday morning to that. I tried to keep an open mind about Jeremy Pruitt, even though at the time of the hire, and especially after all of the guys that they could have had or tried to have, especially Leach.
Hey, Mel Tucker was a finalist for that job.
Yeah, there you go. I was definitely skeptical, but I also knew he was walking into a rebuilding job, so I tried to keep an open mind. They actually did have a couple good wins last year, but then ended it with two pretty lopsided losses, and now they've started this season with two really bad losses. And I think Pruitt's in over his head. I think he doesn't inspire confidence. Some of his comments after that game the other night, first of all, he just completely threw the kid under the bus who had the busted coverage on the 75-yard play. And then Jeremy Pruitt himself, I wouldn't necessarily advise him using this analogy. He himself made a Titanic reference on Monday morning. I wouldn't advise that when you're the coach of a program that does kind of seem like the Titanic right now. So, I mean, it's bad. Now, if not for that busted coverage on the 75-yard play, they probably win that game the other night, and maybe people don't feel quite as panicky. But, you're supposed to be 2-0 at this point. Like, those were two games you should have won, and you're just trying to get to a better than 5-7 last year, and you're losing these games, and you've still got the SEC schedule coming up. This could get really ugly.
Now, it does help them that the rest of the SEC East, save for Georgia, looks pretty wobbly. And I think
lost their quarterback.
Starting quarterback, yeah. I think if they can somehow get a little bit of momentum and be competitive, even in these games they're probably going to lose. I'm not saying they're losing to Chattanooga, obviously. I think they'll win that. But if they do go 1-6, my friend. Yeah, well, if they do go 1-6, then at least if they can find a way to get to a bowl game. If they don't, I think what this has all done is usually a coach is going to get 4 years. I think he is walking right into a really hot seat for 2020. I think they're not going to fire him this year. Now, if they lose to Chattanooga, I would say all bets are probably off. But if they go 5-7 or worse, I think he's looking at a must-win big season in 2020, and I think that is going to make recruiting a lot harder as they get to an early signing day. And I think that's where it gets really challenging, because now all the benefit of the doubt is going to go away. Like you said, they should be 2-0. Now I think there's a lot of doubt about whether he's the right guy. And look, maybe they'll pull off an upset in one of these games and they won't be 1-6. But it's looking way shakier than I really thought. And again, I don't think they should fire him at this point, because I think you got to give him time to get some momentum. But I think even his biggest believers have to be a little skeptical after the way this has been handled the last couple of weeks.
We're running low on time. We want to get some mailbag questions.
Let's get to the mailbag.
We've yet to mention a word about the Clemson Texas A&M game. So I would just say real quickly, the two toughest games we thought for Clemson in the regular season would be A&M and Syracuse. They handled A&M. They kept them out of the end zone for 59 minutes plus. A&M finally got in the end zone at the very end. It was an extremely impressive performance. Syracuse just gave up 63 points to Maryland. that game does no longer seems like it's going to be a challenge for Clemson. Is anybody going to touch them in the regular season? Is this going to be a, you know, how many points does Clemson win by every week season?
Yeah, I think they're going to be 13-0. I'll be shocked if anybody beats them before the playoff. Shocked.
Not just beats them. I don't know if anybody's going to even be competitive with them because they're such a... I mean, Florida State is not very good right now.
Miami is not
very good. I was looking at their schedule the other day saying... And that Miami, yeah, Miami's not on the regular season schedule. You know, maybe Syracuse has played them tough the last 2 years. Maybe they get off the mat and do something this week, but that seems very unlikely. So it's going to be a weird thing where the number one team in the country, the defending national champions, you know, that's the ABC primetime game this week. And I can't imagine people are going to be saying, oh, I got to watch Clemson Syracuse. It's going to be a really weird situation where the team that normally you want to watch the number one team in the country every week, but if you just think they're going to win by 30 or 40 every week, it become kind of anticlimactic. We did not do the emails last week, so we definitely need to do them this week. As always, you can send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. All right, Bruce, first question from a address I've never seen before. Rob Quarry in Listwell, Ontario, Canada. I hope I said the name of that city correctly. Hi, Bruce and Storm. Big fan of your show, your insight analysis. As a Florida Gator fan, I'm enjoying seeing Tennessee starting 0-2. I've seen a few tweets about how Mike Leach would not have lost those games. Mike Leach, by the way, does occasionally lose to an FCS opponent. How do you feel a more proven head coach like Greg Schiano would have fared to Tennessee had that hiring gone through? It's funny. We talk about, oh, they could have had Leach, but, you know, they actually hired Greg Schiano. How would that be going right now?
I don't think it would be going this bad. I think the people who are like, oh, Greg Schiano would have been a terrible fit there, I don't know how they necessarily would know that. I mean, Greg Schiano had one head coaching job in college football, and it went very well. I mean, for the people who, and this is a lot of people who I would say are in the SEC footprint, have no idea how awful Rutgers was before he got there. I mean, he made Rutgers pretty competitive and pretty good, and without almost any resources. You know, you talk to people who've coached at Rutgers, and they will tell you there's a lot of those kids in the state do not want to go to play at Rutgers, and he made them pretty competitive. I mean, this was a guy who Michigan wanted to hire at one point. So I'm not saying he would have gone in there and had them in the top 15, but I think he's really smart, and I think he is a guy who would have done a lot better than what they have right now, to be honest. I'm not saying
Rutgers now.
Yeah, I mean,
there'd be more appreciation for what he did.
Not the head coach.
He won 11 games in a season at Rutgers, which now everybody just assumes is going to be the cellar dweller of the Big Ten for the foreseeable future. So, yeah, I think now it's hard to evaluate this in a vacuum. If he was such an unpopular hire to begin with, that's a tough environment to walk into, where you're kind of fighting from a hole right from the first week. But, you know, having been in it through an even more difficult situation, an even worse rebuilding job, yeah, I think you would probably be handling this a lot better.
Here's the thing about Schiano. I'll say this quick. He knows what he's doing as a head coach because he's done it. I'm not saying if he goes into the NFL, different, but as a college head coach, and I've talked to him in years past about certain situations in terms of if you were the head coach at Miami, if you're the head coach, he's really smart and has a greater big picture understanding than I think a lot of guys who go in to try to interview for jobs. And I don't think a lot of people maybe know that or see that side of him. So again, I think he would have been better than what they have. I have no doubt. You know, that's not saying that much at this point, but I think he would have done better than a lot of people think.
Okay. As I was looking at what's kind of a lackluster week of games this coming season, or this coming week, one that kind of snuck up on me, I was like, oh, Purdue TCU. That could be interesting. Logan Patterson, this email actually came in after the first week. Purdue's week one loss to Nevada was obviously disappointing. Looking ahead, I see just one game I think they should win, Illinois. Two expected losses with Penn State and Wisconsin and 8 toss-ups. 6-6 seems like a good outcome for 2019, but it seemed like there was an expectation Braun would have this program at least 7-5 with a 9-3 ceiling. If Rahm is around for two more years after this, what's the best you can see him pulling off in West Lafayette? The Nevada loss didn't really affect my any sort of long-term thinking about Jeff Brohm there, did it for you?
No, I don't think so. And look, I think they have some really good young talent. They just need more of it. And I think at some point they will get that. But, I think we'll find out a lot more about them as they go through the grind of a pretty competitive Big Ten West. But and I saw Nevada get blown off the field. You know, I kept on looking at that score with Oregon, but we'll see. I mean, am I wrong?
Last year they lost to Eastern Michigan. Yeah, last year they lost to Eastern Michigan, I think in week two or three. And then that same team turned around and blew out Ohio State later in the season. I think when you're a program like that, it's kind of like Northwestern too. They often suffer some really bad early season losses, and then next thing you know, a month or two later, they're beating Wisconsin or Michigan State or somebody like that. I just think when you're a program that's not, overrun with talent, the obvious exceptions of Rondell Moore, George Karlaftis, who's been an absolutely unblockable freshman defensive end, they're not loaded with talent, and so that makes you vulnerable to upsets from just about anybody. Other than the programs at the very top, everybody else is capable of losing to whoever on a given week. I still think he's a really good coach. You talk about what's happened to Rutgers since Yana. Look at what's happened to Western Kentucky since Braun. I mean, they were scoring 45 points a game and winning 11 or 12 games in a season when he's at Western Kentucky. Now they're terrible. So I think he knows what he's doing. Here's an interesting one. Chris Pugh. Hey, Bruce and Stu, I've noticed more and more media members are open about the teams they cheer for. Peter Burns, LSU, Clay Travis, Tennessee, Al Duncan's a UGA fan, Maria Taylor, while not as open as most, is obviously a UGA fan. What are your thoughts on this? It used to be pretty clear in an unspoken rule that you don't let fandom out in the public. Has this changed, and do you think it's a good thing?
That's a good question. It is definitely different. And look, I think it's different depending on the roles of different people who are involved in this. I mean, some of the people that were mentioned in there, I wouldn't call are reporters or, they're just commentators or maybe not even that. So I don't think
Clay's the reason Jeremy Pruitt's at Tennessee right now.
Yeah. I think that's a different case entirely because he's never been shy about just, talking and saying whatever. But I think when you're talking about people who are actually in the middle of talking about games or working on broadcasts, I think you can't go in that direction. I think if it's something where, do you feel like sports writers are held to a different standard maybe in terms of what they can say? Because certainly Bill Simmons, I think, was a good example of that, where he embraced being a Boston Celtics, Boston guy. I feel like we have friends. I think it's different if you're like, let's say, Pat Forty. You grew up in Colorado. You cover college sports and some other things, but you're open about being a Denver Broncos fan. But as far as I know, Pat's never covering the NFL. So I don't,
right.
I don't think that's an issue. And I think ultimately it's really on the fans what they take issue with and what they accept and how they feel, how credible you are.
Bill Simmons definitely is the one who changed that mold completely because – yes, the traditional newspaper type sports reporter was expected to be 100% neutral, never mention any sort of, personal connection to a team. And Bill kind of blew that out of the water and has been extremely popular. And I think created kind of a new generation of media. Now, I would say expectations are probably different with TV, especially, former players, former coaches, they're not shy about rooting for their favorite team on TV. I've never gotten the sense Maria Taylor is a Georgia homer.
I haven't really either.
But she was a Georgia athlete, and so because of that, I think nobody's going to pretend that she's not a fan of Georgia. I haven't seen it affect her, the content in any way. But it's different when you're a writer, and I talked about this leading up to the Stanford Northwestern game. If you're somebody who, if you're never going to step foot in a coach's office or a locker room, and you're just kind of opining from afar, then I think, play it up, be a fan. It's not like people don't enjoy that kind of content. I enjoy plenty of content from writers who are clearly a fan of the team they're writing about. But if you are, you know, trying to build the trust of coaches and players, and you want them to open up to you and give you information that's, frankly, they are, you know, it's kind of sensitive. I don't think you can be out there at the same time saying, like, I want my team to beat your team. And I, you know, so it's different expectations for different people based on their roles.
Yeah, and I saw an interesting example just on the flight out to Colorado. I happened to be watching NFL Network, and they had James Jones, who's a former NFL receiver, and it was obviously the Packers-Bears game. And I thought his comments, at some point I thought he had weed the Packers. And usually when you hear somebody say we in their broadcast capacity or TV capacity, you're like kind of like, whoa. But
cringe.
Yeah, a little bit. But then Andrew Siciliano, who is the host, I thought his next question was diffused it pretty well by pointing out, and look, James Jones, and I don't mean this in a negative, but James Jones wasn't Brett Favre or isn't like one of these guys who is, even Michael Irvin, you know, great cowboy, you know, defined by that. And maybe he is to Green Bay Packers fans, and I'm not aware of it. But I thought when he kind of turned and brought that into the questioning, it made me think, okay, you know what? This is a positive in this case, because here's a guy who played in the Packers-Bears rivalry, you know, gets it. Now we're getting his perspective and his expertise. And I think if you're the audience, I think that in that case is a real benefit, as opposed to, oh, this is a guy who's just, you know, rooting and he doesn't, you know, he's not bringing anything to the table. And I think if you do that, I think it's a win for the audience. And look, I think that's a little different example again than the question, but I think those things, at least if you're honest and open about it, I think it's up to the audience to see what they think is credible and what they take issue with.
Speaking of fans of a team in the media, I was when I was down the LSU sideline at the end of the game, I ran into a familiar face from, you may remember from ESPN, Kaylee Hartung, who is now she's now a news reporter for ABC, for Good Morning America. She was at CNN before that. She grew up in Baton Rouge, huge LSU fan. But I think, you know, when she was actually covering college football, she wasn't quite as open about that. Now she can obviously do that. Lastly, Tom McHale's Stu and Bruce, once upon a time, earlier this offseason, there was discussion about a trip to Ames for the Iowa State-Iowa game. Given Iowa State's poor showing against Northern Iowa and subsequent drop in the polls, the public wants to know, is a trip to Ames still a possibility for Cyclones versus Hawkeyes, especially now that ESPN game day is coming? Well, you didn't get that game, did you?
I did not get that game. Somebody else at Fox got that game. But I think, Stu, it would be a good one for you. You've never experienced that game, the Cy-Hawk Trophy game. You ready to go?
Well, fortunately, the Athletic, I am not going to be going, but the Athletic will be well represented. Not just Scott Docterman, our Iowa Hawkeyes writer, but Max Olson will be there. And I don't know that anybody in the media has been more hoping and crossing his fingers that this would become the big game day game than Max, because he now lives in Lincoln. He's very, very plugged in at Iowa State. So look for his coverage. I got to tell you, you know, I don't know how you do it every week, Bruce. I don't go to many games, travel much during the season anymore. And I swear, I'm just old. These trips take years off my life. This Texas one wasn't everything that could go wrong on the way back, where closed runway at SFO, you know, before I even left to go to the airport, it was already a 3.5 hour delay. But, you know, it's late, late night, especially if you cover a primetime game. It's a late, late night Saturday night. Then it turns into a late night Sunday night. I got to pick my spots. So, no, I will not be turning back around and heading to Ames this week. But I'm really excited to watch game day from there and watch the game, because I always love it when they go to, first, in this case, a place they've never been. I always love it when they go to the less obvious campuses.
Yes. And I'm happy for those fan bases. And as Matt Campbell he told us on the Audible like 3 or 4 months ago, that fan base was a big reason why he took that job. And look, he's a highly marketable coach. He could have probably gone almost any place else. And so credit to them to get the spotlight they have deserved. And I can't wait to see how that one goes.
All right, well, that's it for this week. Again, we're so excited that the Audible is on the Athletic now. And like we said, guys, all you Athletic subscribers, keep an eye out Thursday morning for a little mini episode that we'll be doing. That's for subscribers only. If you are not a subscriber yet to The Athletic, A, what is wrong with you? B, go give it a shot. You can try it for free for a week, theathletic.com/free trial. And I know I say this at the end every week, but we've been getting some our iTunes reviews or our Apple Podcast reviews have not been as favorable lately, and a lot of it has been about the sound quality. Well, problem solved. So if you enjoy the podcast, please go on there, give us a 5-star review, write something nice. Let's push some of those angry ones further down the page. We'll see you next time. If you enjoy The Audible, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Rate and review us. It helps get the word out. By the way, you can also find The Audible now on The Athletic. Go to theathletic.com/theaudible. Our producer is John Hayes. Our theme music is Dangerous by Kevin and the Octaves. You can find their music on Spotify, wherever you get your favorite music from. Follow me, Stu, on Twitter at SL Mandel. Follow Bruce at Bruce Feldman CFB. And if you haven't done so already, subscribe to The Athletic. You can try it for free for 7 days at theathletic.com/free trial. Talk about it for years.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a 1-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a 1-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a 1-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.